Roni's Own Radio.
Can you hear me now?
Stop it. Welcome, everyone, back to Roni's Own Radio. My wife is here.
Hi.
Oh, my God.
Am I a little loud? Shall I back it off a smidge?
She's just wild, folks.
Not really.
Okay. Well, yeah.
You're just crazy.
Maybe.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. What are we... Right. The show.
That's what I thought we were here for.
Welcome to episode 26. That's 26.
Correct. One more than 25.
That is right. And I have gotten some really nice emails and really nice thoughts from people. And I just, you know, want to welcome the new people that are listening and say thank you. And you're breathing.
Am I breathing too loud?
Close to the...
Wow, how about I sit back here? Is that good?
Yeah, that's fine.
Am I spiking too much there?
Well, no, I could just... You're breathing.
Wow, that's kind of funny, actually. Better than other things.
Well, yeah. I'm thinking. Oh, boy. This is a...
It's a silly show.
It's almost a rich, secret moment, maybe. It's just silly stuff would happen when he would have his crew together. It's just wacky, weird.
Right.
But see, I don't laugh like Earl. That's different. He has a very distinct laugh. Love you, Earl. Love you. Oh, my God. There was some kind of gurgle that come out of you, man.
I can't help it.
I guess not.
I didn't think you could hear that.
I think deaf people could hear that.
Sorry.
All right. Well,
I think you should edit that out, though.
I'm not editing nothing.
Oh, great.
I ain't editing nothing.
Sorry, folks. Can't help it. It's, you know.
Oh, man.
It was a throat gurgle.
You know, I don't even know what to... Usually I have a topic that we kind of discuss lightly. I don't even really have one now. let's see. No, anyway, we've got... Are you done with all that stuff? No,
we'll see, won't we?
You're just a musical person. You just got...
It's a perfectly natural function.
Uh-huh.
Everybody has them.
Okay. All right.
This is what happens when you ask me to record right after dinner.
Well, okay. I feel the love.
Good, you should.
I hope so.
There's lots of it.
Uh-huh. All right. Okay.
Is your computer made a little
happy woman? Well, there's a happy woman in one of my firewire. Wow. I didn't say anything bad. Really.
No, that's true.
Okay. All right. Anyway, all right. The show's like 4 hours now. Okay, so I have gotten some really great emails from people. And a couple of them, not 15 or 20, but a couple of them actually were pretty funny, is one guy would email me and say, something that, this is pretty funny stuff, you know, and I'd, all right, back, thanks a lot, you know, hope you enjoy it. And then and he'd write back in big, bold letters, no, I mean, this is real funny stuff. And I go, okay, thank you very much. And then he wrote back again and goes, I've just put a link to you on our forum for our group, and man, I'm telling everybody about it. I go, wow.
Well, that's good.
Okay, you know. So.
That's good. More people should listen.
That's true. And then also there was a guy that watched Revenge of the Sox and said it was funny. Now, you know, now that there.
Well, that is something
that
special.
Is something. Because
that is because not too many people saw Revenge of the Sox, and the ones that did didn't, you know, they didn't quite get it, I don't think.
Well, it's been downloaded a number of times. I've been checking on it, but it's just I've not got a lot of response. We will do a show about it at one point. We'll sit down with William and talk about it.
That'd be fun. That'd be actually a lot of fun.
I'm glad you approve.
I do.
Okay, so anyway. Please continue to tell folks about Rony Zone Radio. It is an acquired taste. It's kind of like, I don't know, Ben and Jerry's Chunky Monkey or something. You know?
Ew, has nuts in it.
Well, okay. Some people like nuts in their ice cream.
Nuts don't belong in ice cream.
Okay.
That's just me.
All right. So, continue to share and tell people about the show. We really appreciate it. And for the new people that are listening, hello. Welcome. Welcome you Arizona people. Welcome you New Jersey people. Welcome you Tennessee folks and South Carolina, North Carolina, and all over the place. Welcome to you. I'm waving.
I wish you could see it. He is. Well, he's really waving. It's hilarious. Welcome you Arizona people. Wave. Welcome you New Jersey people. Wave.
You know,
it's radio.
I understand. Listen to me. Listen to me. I think my mother lied to me. I think I am actually part Italian, and I do not think I am Irish, because I talk with my hands.
Funny, because I've always been convinced I'm part Italian also, because I do tend to talk with my hands quite a bit, though they're pretty calm right now. They're very tired from all that work earlier, but, you know, cooking and cleaning and that kind of stuff, so.
Thank God. Paisan.
Yeah, but no, I'm not Italian either.
All right. So anyway, that's... Sorry, Mom, kind of kidding there, kind of. But I just talk with my hands, and I don't know that Irish people talk with their hands. We'll have to have Bono on the show and ask him.
Hey, that would be something.
Anyway, because it's funny, even on the induction in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, he was saying that Bruce Springsteen was Irish, so I think Bono thinks everybody's Irish. It's kind of funny. Okay.
Well, maybe Springsteen
is. Maybe so. So a couple of things to look forward to. We just recorded a interview with Andrew Bettis from In the Beginning, and that's going to... Actually, that's this show. Wow.
Well, it really
wait,
is.
Wait. We just recorded it. I'm excited about it. So we're... On this show, we're going to have Andrew Bettis, boy, and it is a good interview. We're going to talk about the Lucas Effect. The Lucas Effect. And the premise is what Lucas has done, how it affects movies and the movie business and et cetera, that kind of a thing. So that is the gist of the show here. And something to look forward to in the future, I recorded an interview with a gentleman named John Cosper. Cosper the Friendly Ghost.
No. Maybe it's Cosper the Friendly Host.
Wow.
What do you think of that?
See, she digs me out of holes. Really.
That's what you meant to say, I'm sure, right?
Absolutely. Okay. So anyway, John Cosper is a funny guy. And in that show, we will talk about what do the disciples have to do with Chubby Bunny. So we will find that out.
Do you even define what Chubby Bunny is?
Well, Chubby Bunny is played, well, okay. It's played a lot in... youth groups in churches. So if you've never been to church, let me just kind of explain. Chubby Bunny is when you put a certain amount of what is it?
Marshmallows
in your mouth, and then you, what do you, push your cheeks together?
You're asking me. I never played Chubby Bunny.
Okay. Anyway, you put a bunch of marshmallows in your mouth, and you have to say words out of your mouth while you're doing this. So that's Chubby Bunny.
Yes.
Anyway.
And it's not, you're not saying Chubby Bunny every time. You have to
right,
say,
it's, I'm saying different words.
It's different words. So like somebody would make you say Guppy.
Right.
And you say, okay.
Right. Yeah, so Chubby Ooh. Bunny. Yeah, all the people that used to go to church will probably laugh at that, and the people that have never gone to church will probably just think
just
about that.
It kind of sounds cute. I had a vision of a little cartoon bunny that was kind of chubby.
Yeah.
A little round bunny.
But I also think you have to kind of push your cheeks together and Chubby Bunny.
Well, you
I,
can't. I think, because if you have okay. marshmallows in your mouth, you don't need to push your cheeks together.
Okay. The people that haven't emailed this show yet that I know listen on their iTunes and iPodder a lot... please email now, and let's talk about Chubby Bunny. Why not? Let's talk about it before the next show. How's that?
Be kind of fun.
Okay. So anyway, Andrew Bettis interview discussion this time. Next show, we will be talking to John Cosper. And we have a major Tatooine TV announcement in the next Roni Zone Radio show. Okay. And that show is with
dun,
the interview.
Dun, dun.
That's right. And that is with the interview with John Cosper. Now, here's the thing. We also may have a little mini episode coming close to Valentine's Day. That's pretty important about Valentine's Day. So, anyway, just a couple of things to look forward to. So, what a weird way to start the show.
Yeah, it is very weird.
Okay. So, without further ado, we're going to move on to the next section of our show.
Roni's on the radio.
Spotlight.
And now everyone are waiting.
What?
Okay. Roni's Own Radio Spotlight.
Woo! Spotlight!
No. We already played the intro music.
Oh,
so
never mind.
All right. That's nice, though. All right. Turn on your spotlight.
Yes.
Let it shine wherever you go. Let it make a happy glow. Come on. All the world to see.
Yeah, no, I don't think
turn
so.
On your... Okay. Probably the four listeners that I had are now gone.
Probably.
Anyway, this spotlight is about probably the biggest annoyance I have about the internet ever, period.
Spam?
Could be.
Pop-ups?
No. Sounds like a...
Viruses?
That sounds like an Earthlink commercial or something. Oops, sorry. Do you want to plug them?
No, we definitely don't want to plug them.
Okay. No. My biggest annoyance with the internet is 15,000 million passwords.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you do?
It's not just the internet, though. I mean, it's like everything.
Well, okay. But you know what I'm saying? All these passwords. And now with the whole SOX deal, you have to change your passwords every whatever.
Some people don't know what SOX is. So let's talk about SOX a little bit. Since this is my area of expertise, should I explain?
Okay.
Well, first of all, I'm an expert in this area, and I wouldn't really say truly expert, but only because this is what I do for a living, is that I audit processes in IT department of a mortgage company. Because those fabulous gentlemen at Enron and WorldCom and MCI and the other places, yeah, those guys, because they messed up with their finances, Sarbanes and Oxley, two congressmen, decided to come up with an act called the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002, and it basically says you need to have really good processes and controls around your financials and your information that you keep on people or your customers, and it has to be audited every year. So basically what happens is the auditors come in and they look at things and they say, you have really good process controls around this, but you don't around this. Fix it or we're reporting you out to the public, and if they report you to the public, you pretty much can say goodbye to your company, yeah, because it'll be bad. So basically what we're looking at is that's what SOX is all about. So it's called SOX based on Sarbanes-Oxley.
Okay.
How's that?
Good. So because of that, there are a lot of IT departments and companies where folks work on computers that are hooked into the network that they require that they change their passwords every 90 days. 45 days.
Most companies, it's 45 days. Some of them will go with 90 days, but
so,
it's usually 45 days.
So that really proves my point, is that passwords are just...
And it's not just your standard password anymore. There's usually a very specific schematic to it.
So it's letters and numbers
and characters,
special characters and all
so
this
many,
kind of stuff.
It's so many characters long and so many... Yeah, it's and
now,
you can't use the same one you've used before, and it'll catch it if you increment by one.
Yep. Yeah. So the bottom line is passwords are just a bane to my existence, because if you do anything on the internet, even if it's above board, you're going to visit sites and they want you to log in. And you always have to have your login, your password. I don't know about you, but I mean, there must be 30, 40 different sites for all kinds of different things that I got to log into. And, you know, some people have a real kind of lackadaisical attitude about their Hotmail account or their Gmail or whatever. It's like, eh, I don't care. It's just my email. Eh, it's not that big of a deal. So
it is when you start doing online banking and they send you information.
Right, right. So what I have discovered is a very interesting program. It's open source, so it's kind of cool. It's called KeePass. KeePass. Okay?
KeePass?
KeePass. It's KeePass. KeePass.
KeePass.
So that is an open source program that is secure, that you need a password to get into the program that stores all your passwords. And there's different... I understand. I don't need to say anything, do I? But I'm just telling you.
Okay, go ahead.
But it's secure that, I mean, anyway. So you need one password to get into this program that stores all your passwords, okay? Now, first of all, I want to say that we are not guaranteeing anything. We're not implying that we're guaranteeing. We're not selling this program, da 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 da. We're just recommending it on information that it has worked for me. So we're saying try it out.
Look into it.
Okay. So this KeePass is pretty interesting. It has different little levels. And what's cool is that you can have different databases that it'll create for you to use for different things. I mean, you can hook into one database and use that one. Or you can choose to use another database, and then you can have passwords for each database for those passwords. So it's really
sounds very confusing.
But if you really stay on top of it, there's a lot of really cool things for that program. And what's really neat about it is once you open it up, you can drag the password, or you could drag the login information over to the field on the web page.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
And you can also drag the password that is dotted out, obviously, and that's the norm. And you can drag the password into the password field and click on OK and get in.
Oh, so you don't remember what it is.
Right. No. You don't have to remember, no.
Right. Mm-hmm. Once you put it into your KeePass
area,
you don't have to remember it anymore because it's already there. But here's the thing. What happens if you have to change it? Automatically, then you got to go back and change it in KeePass?
Yeah, you just have to remember to do it in KeePass first and then use that to get into the program.
Right. But what I'm saying is if for whatever reason you choose to change it in the, let's say you're going into Yahoo Mail.
Right.
And I already have my password of 123 Sam.
Mm-hmm. But
I'm just saying that, but and then I decide I don't want 123 Sam, I want Sam 456. Mm-hmm. Now I change it in Yahoo.
That's what I'm saying. Use KeePass as a first point of contact. Change it there first.
You
then
can change it in Pass? You can change
absolutely.
It
absolutely, yes, yes.
Oh, that's really cool.
And what's really cool is that they have a password creator. You can set it for any length, and you tell it letters, numbers, special characters, and all that.
So it'll automatically set something up for you.
Correct.
So you don't have to worry about it.
That's right.
Dude, that's pretty awesome.
Yep. So anyway, you click on it, it'll create your password, and then there's a little button that, I mean, it'll dot out the passwords for you. But then you click on the little button, and it'll undot it. So if you wanted to, you know, maybe write it down or whatever you wanted to do. Okay, so KeePass, cool thing. There are a lot of password programs out there, so check them out. But anyway, check out KeePass as well. Now, here's the thing, is that I do work at work, and I do, you know, stuff on the computer at home. So, what do you normally do? I mean, if you have KeePass on your home computer, that doesn't help you at work.
No.
Okay. So, let's kind of take a step into, we're going to talk about a couple of things in this spotlight, is USB drives.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thumb drives, whatever you want to call it. Now, flash drive, USB drive, whatever. And there's actually different levels now. There's actually, it's called an S drive, something like that. But anyway, it's just more specific, and it's faster, and it's more memory as things go. Mm-hmm. So there's a couple of links on the show notes as well as for KeePass, obviously. And this whole USB drive is pretty incredible stuff. You can put XP on there. You can purchase, you know, XP, put it on your thumb drive, and then use that to boot up into XP. and possibly use that if you have trouble with your computer. You can also put Firefox in there and use Firefox to surf the internet on another computer. Now, obviously, you're going to need a USB connection to use that USB drive.
Right.
Okay. So if like you're in an airport, you cannot use that, obviously, to use that computer. So, I mean, if you're using KeePass to create all your passwords, you're going to need some type of backup, and you may need it for whatever reason.
Right.
So anyway, obviously, for most programs, you can see forgot password and send it to your account and then get in there that way. Okay. But anyway, KeePass, pretty cool. A password store that's secure, that's pretty cool. And then you have the USB drives that you can store all kinds of stuff. These little USB drives, people have created these open source programs for like word processing and calendars and all this kind of stuff. And even things that hook into Firefox. So you have Firefox Lite on your USB, and you can use that to surf, but then you can hook in like, you know, different little plugins for that. So it's a huge little cottage industry that's really cropping up with this whole USB drive thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but and here's the other thing is just so people know, and again, this comes back to, you know, my job, my expertise or knowledge that I've learned. Thumb drives at work are starting to be questioned
mm-hmm.
because of the fact that you can basically...
Right.
Steal information.
Right.
So that's kind of that's obviously if you have a company, if you work for a company that's pretty tight, you're going to want to check with your info security or your internet networking, whoever controls your permissions for software, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
you're going to want to check with them and make sure that they're cool with having a thumb drive. We don't want to encourage somebody to do something they're not supposed to do and get somebody into trouble. But by all means, if you can do it, go for it.
Yep. So, anyway, for sure, KeePass will work on your home PC. Also work on a thumb drive if you want to take it to somebody else's house or whatever. Okay. Also check with work. That's fine. Let's go ahead and do that. But anyway, there's just a lot of different things to think about. We want to continue to kind of expose you to different types of different softwares and different kinds of hardwares that will really benefit you. And the only thing I'll say is I bought a SanDisk 2 gig thumb drive. And it acted a little weird here at the house sometimes. So I'll just tell you that is that maybe the bigger kind of little USB drives you get, it may have little problems. I think it was a firmware problem with the little USB drive. But anyway, check it out. You know, make sure that you keep your receipt. Take it back if there's a problem or whatever. Anyway, KeePass, thumb drive. Little cottage industry around the little programs that go on the thumb drive, but something to check out. And now, get ready, everybody. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Here is Andrew Bettis to talk about the Lucas Effect. Get ready. Here we go.
Woohoo!
All right, we are back with Roni's Own Radio, and I am privileged to have Andrew Bettis on the phone. Andrew, say hello.
Hey, what's going on, y'all?
All right, this is the host of In the Beginning, a Star Wars radio show. And Andrew, if you don't mind, just kind of give a short synopsis of what the show is.
Well, basically what it is I'm kind of one of the odd fans of the Star Wars fan community, and I'm a big prequel buff. So basically on the show, we just kind of look at, you know, themes from the prequel trilogy, criticisms of it, some of the characters, some of the plot lines. Basically, we just focus on the Phantom Menace, Attack of the Clones, and Revenge of the Sith.
Very good. And because it's the most recent set of them, I think that there's a lot of meat to it, and they're kind of new to a lot of the fans. So check out his show. It's a great show, and he's doing a lot of different things. So this is the guy to watch.
I appreciate it, Jeff.
No problem. Okay, now, here's my struggle. As you know, Roni's Own Radio is a different type of a show. To say the least. And I did want to cover Star Wars, but in covering Star Wars, I did not want to do retreads of anything. I did not want to retell anything. I didn't want to go over something again and again, because there are a lot of great shows out there that do that. And so in thinking about it, and I kind of was talking to you about it, I wanted to do a show called The Lucas Effect. Now, the premise I'm taking is almost It's a Wonderful Life kind of a thing. Is if Lucas never was born, these types of things would have never happened. Now, in talking through these points, we're going to mention others that probably feel the same way, but I doubt when we get to the end, as we start to make our points, then people will say, well, that's true. Because Lucas really is an innovator in a lot of ways. So that's really the gist. We're going to talk about Lucas the man, Lucas the storyteller, Lucas the father, Lucas the rebel, et cetera, et cetera. So Andrew's really done a great job really kind of digging in deep and finding out stuff that really I didn't find. So let's kind of get started. Now, George Lucas was born May 14th, 1944. In Modesto, California. Now, Northern California, I mean, do you have any idea about that type of a mindset there?
Well, I don't. I'm from the South, so okay. I don't really know a lot about the West. But I do know that growing up, he was one of the more rebellious kids, and he was very much kind of the prototype of a Western, you know, kind of, you know, rebel, outgoing kid. He liked to race cars. That was kind of represented in American mm-hmm. Graffiti. So I don't know much about the area he grew up in, but he is a person, you know, he was a rebel mm-hmm. growing up, and that can definitely be translated, you know, as you'll see throughout this interview, into, you know, further decisions he made down the road.
Well, definitely, I think that he also had a lot of dreams, and so we're going to begin to see that take shape as we go forward. So let's kind of start on this, is that Lucas really loved stories. Now, as we know, he saw a lot of serial films like Flash Gordon, that kind of a thing. But he loved stories. So I remember THX 1138 was just pretty weird. Now, you had found something that Irvin Kershner said about that movie?
Yeah, it's on actually on that on the DVD set mm-hmm. when mm-hmm. The special features disc. Irvin Kershner actually said that right from the beginning, he knew that George had a unique vision. As soon as he saw THX 1138, which is, I agree with you, I think it's a real bizarre-looking film, and mm-hmm. it's a little over my head, but Kershner recognized talent as soon as he saw it.
I also remember, too, that I just recently watched THX, the director's cut and all that,
right.
And it was pretty interesting to listen to the commentary. And even though you're seeing very abstract types of things, is that he was trying to make points, and you just kind of lean back and you go, oh, my gosh, that's what he's talking about.
Yeah.
Just the whole claustrophobic and how that if we continue on with this whole antiseptic life, that one day it's going to be all white, and it there's a possibility could be what the future is and how important being an individual is and never to just kind of blend in. That's another trend that we're going to start to see with him. But also, I do want to point out, I don't think this was really brought out at all, is that he really wanted to be an animator at the beginning. And he loved to animate different things. I remember I saw early on an old test film that he did was basically animation with real abstract ideas. And I remember listening to an interview, I believe it was Cindy Williams, about American Graffiti, is that she felt that he was a little uncomfortable working with actors because he had done a lot of animation before, and that's what he was comfortable in. So it was kind of he knew he had to do it, he loved the story, but it was kind of a difficult step into that type of arena. And that's when they noticed that he was real quiet, and you never really knew what to kind of expect out of him.
Right, and also on that same, just pulling something from that same documentary that was mm-hmm. run on A&E, it was actually, I think it was a challenge from Francis Ford Coppola of George Lucas to do a humorous movie or kind of a lighthearted movie mm-hmm. like American Graffiti. So it was definitely a challenge to him. I didn't know about the animation, but
yep.
I do know that it was a big challenge to him.
Yep. So THX is what he started in. But even from that point, he had this idea in the back of his head. He wanted to do an homage to the Saturday serials. He loved that type of a theme, and it really spread over into another type of movie. But anyway, we're going to stick with this one. Now, Lucas was inspired by Joseph Campbell. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. And Joseph Campbell, what was his deal? Kind of explain that to us.
Well, Joseph Campbell, he worked in the fields of comparative mythology and religion, and basically the central thesis, I guess, of most of his writings were that all religions and all people are looking for an unknown kind of immanent force from which all essences come and eventually return to. And this is kind of interesting because you can draw the parallel from exactly what he wrote to what Yoda talks about in Empire Strikes Back, you know, when the force, feel the force surround you, you know, run through you. It's almost exactly like Joseph Campbell is talking in the movie.
Mm.
He also wrote The Hero with a Thousand Faces, which lays out the hero's journey, or monomyth, kind of.
Mm.
And you can trace out, there's actually a website that does this, you can trace out every step, or almost every step, that Campbell mentions in his book, and you can parallel it to something in Star Wars. For example, he talks about early on the call to adventure, and that's easily parallel to Princess Leia's, "Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi, you're my only hope," you know, kind of thing. And then also right after that, he talks about crossing the first threshold, you know, kind of breaking through the first barrier, and that is definitely when, you know, Kenobi and Luke Skywalker and Han and Chewie have to escape Tatooine. You know, they're kind of breaking away from the small corner of the world where Luke is known, you know, where he was raised his whole life, breaking out into a larger galaxy. So, then Campbell also in that same book kind of goes into the initiation and the trials that a hero has to go through, and he refers to the Road of Trials, which, if you want to look at the entire original trilogy as a whole, you can see Luke's journey from A New Hope into Return of the Jedi, not Revenge of the Jedi. In how he's redeemed, how he redeems himself, he redeems his father, and Campbell also talks about atonement with the father, which is, of course, Luke redeeming his father and Vader fulfilling the prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very much tied to Campbell's writings. Campbell also refers to he centers a lot of his writings around the mentor, the oracle, and the failed hero, which I would say are Obi-Wan, Yoda, and then probably Biggs, because Biggs, you know, he was right on par with Luke. I guess lots of the deleted scenes we didn't see, we didn't really get to know Biggs, but he eventually does fail, and that kind of what sets Luke apart and gives him his shot to, you know, make his first big mark in the galaxy.
Now, I totally agree with you, and I do see those type of points through the films and the stories, but what, you know, and I don't want to beat this to death, I've said it before, but as we go through these points, they resonate with people.
Right.
They really do. The whole thing about, I got to get out of here. I'm in a small town, whether it's New York, whether it's San Bernardino, whatever town you're in, there's a point where you go, I got to get out of here.
Yep.
I want to do something with my life. I want to join whatever I need to do. Or, you know, the whole crossing the first threshold, breaking through barriers. I can't do this. How do I get over it? And it's just, those types of things really go beyond. I remember an early interview with Lucas. He said he wanted to do Star Wars because he did not want kids to grow up with just watching Dirty Harry.
Yep.
And the thing with the Star Wars films is it really kind of takes you out of the realm of actually the effects in the movie itself. It causes you to kind of think beyond those bounds. And that's what I really enjoy about Star Wars. It kind of gets you out of where you are to think about other things, taking care of other people and all that. It's very interesting that Campbell kind of pointed him in that direction. And Campbell is actually quoted in saying, Lucas is my greatest student.
Exactly. And what you were saying, Jeff, earlier about, you know, kind of breaking out of the normal life, you know, going somewhere else. I'm referencing that documentary again because it was so great, but the way they started it out was really interesting to me because the time frame in which Star Wars was created is really interesting because, you know, you're bracketed by Vietnam on one side and then Reagan on the other, and it's really kind of a surreal thing that he was able to, you know, kind of break away from the negativity of the time and come up with something that, you know, just gave so many people entertainment and so much hope and, you know, brought pleasure to such a great fan community.
Absolutely. Now, let's talk about the lightsaber, mm-hmm. the meaning of the lightsaber.
Well, it's real interesting that in the original trilogy, when I guess everybody first saw the lightsaber,
mm-hmm.
and when you look at the role of the lightsaber in the original trilogy, it's so much more meaningful because it's, you know, Luke receives his father's and then uses it against him, then loses it, and then makes his own. So that kind of mm-hmm. symbolizes him breaking away from being his father's son, which he'll never really break off, but he becomes his own man in Return of the Jedi, and mm-hmm. that's really evident, you know, through Mark Hamill's acting, that Luke is so much more mature, and his own lightsaber kind of shows that he's his own man and he's his own Jedi. In the prequel trilogy, you know, they're a lot cooler, I'd say. You know, the mm-hmm. lightsaber duels are a lot better. The lightsabers look a lot better, but, you know, on Geonosis, you see hundreds of lightsabers, so they really kind of lose meaning in comparison to the original trilogy.
I agree.
And as for the inspiration for the lightsaber and where Lucas might have gotten it, there's a book, or I don't know if it's a book, it's a piece by Isaac Asimov mm-hmm. called Foundation, and Lucas has acknowledged that he gained inspiration from this piece. It spoke of a planet being occupied by a single city, which probably Coruscant, and a weapon that sparked to life with a force field-like blade, which is obviously a lightsaber.
Mm-hmm.
So,
just really quick, is that the one thing that I missed in the whole six films, and I'm serious, is that painting that Ralph McQuarrie did of a stormtrooper with a lightsaber and a light shield.
Yeah.
I wanted to see that light shield.
Yeah.
Somewhere, somebody, and I just... You know, and maybe it was a whole, well, we can't really, I don't know, you know, we can't make it work within the realm of the story. But I just thought it was just so, it was just so cool.
Yeah, well, I'd say that maybe in The Phantom Menace, mm-hmm. I know you're not a big fan of that movie, but during the Naboo battle, the Gungans have something similar to what would have been a light shield. But
that's true.
I don't know if that's exactly what it was, but.
Yeah, that's a very good point. See, Andrew's got it, man. He's helping me out.
The prequels are my thing.
Okay. Now, Indiana Jones, did that have any tie to Star Wars at all?
Well, you can really... my favorite Indiana Jones movie is by far Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Mm-hmm.
And you can really make a lot of ties. You know, Harrison Ford, young Indiana Jones, Mark Hamill, young Luke Skywalker, kind of both finding their way. I would argue that Indiana Jones is a little bit more mature than Luke Skywalker is when we first see them, you know, in their first appearances. But then, I mean, if you want to progress down, you know, I guess it's the last, I think the Temple of Doom, is it the one with Sean Connery?
No, that was Last Crusade.
Last Crusade,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm not a big Indiana Jones buff, but his relationship with his father, I mean, you can tie that into Star Wars as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, both of them have a lot of serious themes, but Lucas makes sure, you know, to keep the fun element in both of them. So there's not a whole lot of parallels that I recognize in them, but those are a couple of them.
Well, what I think is interesting is the whole dichotomy between a farm boy becoming a space hero or a teacher who becomes an archaeological hero. You know what I mean? This whole from nothing, they become something.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Even, you know, the Bible, you know, Jesus born in a stable becomes, you know, a leader of an entire belief system. So,
exactly.
Now, so... We've kind of went through a lot of different things, but Lucas was really intent on creating themes through these stories. These were not just stories, but they were reflecting different themes that really resonate, I think, with anyone. I mean, when you start talking about the atonement with a father and a son and a father really coming back to a point where they are together. I mean, that's deep, man. That cuts through, I think, just about every man alive.
Yeah,
that's just, oh man, and so we can see that these films are not just effects laden films. That really behind them, there's a really underpinning and strength of these stories.
Yep, I agree.
And now another part of Lucas is the rebel filmmaker and businessman. So there was a quote that you had about Lucas about something his movies.
Yep. He says, Lucas has actually said this, and this came as complete news to me. He said that 60% of the movies he's made have not been released, nor would they be successful in his opinion. So, I mean, I had no clue that he had made a lot more. I guess it was in that period between Return of the Jedi and The Phantom Menace, or maybe before 1977, but he's intent on not releasing them, and he didn't think they'd be successful. So,
well, here's a bit of trivia that probably a lot of you younger dogs don't know. Is that when I was a Star Wars fan, I was a fan. When I was in the fan club, I got a notice for a cartoon by Lucasfilm called Twice Upon a Time. And it was never released. It was intended to be released, but it was never released. So, all you huge fanatics, if you can find out information about that, I would be very interested to hear about it. Because I did get something in the mail from the fan club, and that's all I ever heard about it. Twice Upon a Time.
Never heard of that, but okay. I did become a fan in 1999, so.
There you go. But there's more to find out about it.
Yes.
Now, the one thing I think that really stands out about is Lucas doing things differently. I mean, there's a bunch of them, but the one thing is the end credits.
Yep.
What about that?
Well, it's... he wanted to do it, first of all, and from Lucas's demeanor, he was going to do what he wanted. You know, early on he said he told the people at Fox he didn't want more money, he just wanted the rights to his films. So he was very intent on doing things his way and independently. And so the way I tried to reason it out is that having credits at the end are better for viewing audiences because, you know, a lot of older movies that you might see on, like, the movie channels and stuff, you have to sit through a couple of minutes of just boring music and people's names flashing on the screen until you get to the movie. And for Star Wars, you don't. You just dive straight into the action after the opening scroll. So, but in the case of George Lucas, his movies were so technologically advanced that I would think that, you know, I've sat around to look at the credits of his movies, you know, just to marvel at how many people he has on staff, you know, to create these effects. So in his case, he's getting the best of both worlds because people are interested in his case because he was such a pioneer of, you know, who's involved with this movie, but you immediately get into the action and you don't have to sit through, you know, the 5-10 minutes of credits. Well, not 10 minutes, probably more like five. But that was standard at that time. Everybody was putting theirs at the very beginning, and he decided, you know, screw that, I don't want to be a part of that. So he did that, and it ended up putting him in a lot of trouble because he got kicked out of the Directors Guild,
right?
And he's still paying the price because, I don't know, Jeff, I'm sure you've seen it, but the only Oscar nomination for Star Wars is for Best Makeup Job, and Revenge of the Sith was one of the best critically acclaimed movies since Empire. I mean, it was it's regarded as probably the second best of the Star Wars films, and because of his snub back in the 70s that he didn't want to put the credits at the beginning, the Directors Guild and the Academy holds him in disdain, and that's why you don't see, you know, a lot of Star Wars actors getting nominated. Ian McDiarmid, lots of people say that he deserved an Oscar nomination for his stellar performance as Palpatine, but and especially for every single shot in Revenge of the Sith had visual effects in it, and they didn't get nominated. It went to The Chronicles of Narnia, which is a good movie, and like War of the Worlds and a couple other movies, but he's paying for it, definitely.
That's true, and one more thing is this. Let's kind of look back. Is that when Star Wars came out? That's 1977. Before really the hubbub, because they let him get by with the credits at the end at first.
Right.
But I mean, they were up for numerous awards, Best Picture. Let's see here. Let me look through my list here. Best Art Direction, Best Costume Design, Best Effects, Best Film Editing, Best Music, Best Sound, Best Actor, Best Director, Best Picture, Best Writing, and also the Special Achievement Award for Ben Burtt. Now, this was Star Wars.
Right.
But you're right. After that, it was all downhill because they ran the credits at the end of Empire. Then the DGA stepped in and said, if you don't change that, we're going to fine you.
Exactly.
And that was the split. That's when the Rebel really became the Rebel.
Right.
And we'll kind of talk about his trek as a Rebel a little later on, but it's good that we started here because this was really the straw that broke the camel's back.
Exactly.
And he paid the fines, and also that's why he couldn't get Spielberg for I think Return of the Jedi.
Right, because Spielberg was bound by the Directors Guild,
right,
and they wouldn't let him go work. And so that's, I think, I don't know, well, I forgot the name of who directed Return of the Jedi, but it was not Lucas's first choice.
Right, it was Richard Marquand.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
And, but yeah, I mean, he stuck to his guns.
Yep.
And he said, no, I'm not going to change it. And it's funny, once that happened, I mean, that's the way it went from here on out.
Yep.
I wonder if anybody else was fine. So it's kind of interesting that Lucas actually set the standard, paid the price. You know, let's just think just for a second. What would have Return of the Jedi been like with Spielberg behind the camera?
I couldn't. I mean, it would have... Return of the Jedi is one of my favorite of the original trilogy,
mm-hmm,
but I would imagine that some of the lull points, like with the Ewoks and stuff, some of that might have been spiced up, and
mm-hmm,
the action certainly probably would have been better. But with Lucas behind Marquand's, I really wouldn't think that they would have been all that different, because, you know, what Lucas wants, he gets,
mm-hmm,
and he oversaw everything. So, I mean, even though he didn't direct it, he certainly had a significant presence in it. But Spielberg would have made it probably better than it was, I think.
It's just another little segue away is that Spielberg was also on tap to direct Cape Fear.
Really?
And they talk about a scene where, because Spielberg loves these whole tense, almost dying kind of a sequence, and you're just kind of stretched to the limit on something. And there was a scene where I think the daughter was going to fall off of she was holding on to, I think, a drapery off a window or something, and it was coming undone and all this. And they had this whole scene mapped out for Spielberg to use in Cape Fear, and then Scorsese came in, and he was ultimately the one that directed, and so they had to change the film around. But anyway, it's just, Spielberg really has a lot of almost films,
yeah,
under his belt too. But Lucas was, you know, the rebel, the movie maker, the businessman, the innovator. And as we kind of go forward, we'll see how he really set a lot of trends. And so, I mean, let's talk about financing his own film.
Okay. Yeah, like you mentioned, and like I've mentioned, that he valued independence above all.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always been the constant in his career. But as you look back at Star Wars, the 1977, Lucas has admitted, you know, in the first one that he borrowed a whole lot of money from his friends and family and others. And then, I mean, if you know anything about the production of Star Wars, there were times when it was in dire straits. I mean,
mm-hmm,
he had so many different, you know, deadlines that he was having trouble making. He asked for more money. I mean, there was just a lot of problems with it. And there were times that he's admitted that he was scared that Star Wars was going to flop, it would never come out, and then he'd be in more trouble than he had started off with because he would have borrowed so much money. So I think when looking back at Star Wars, and I don't want to get too much into, you know, Lucas's, I don't think he was lucky, but I do think that those paintings by Ralph McQuarrie,
mm-hmm,
were really, really essential to the success of Episode 4 and Lucas, you know, being able to, you know, because that was what got the money from Fox, and I guess that's probably what got everything jump-started, and so that's probably what made him not be in debt to the rest of his family. But Lucas started off at the University of Southern California,
mm-hmm,
was taught by Irwin Kershner,
mm-hmm,
and from that point on, from THX 1138, he and Coppola formed American Zoetrope, which it still exists today, and it's even produced, you know, I think Francis Ford Coppola's daughter actually produced a film. You probably know, what was the name of the film that she directed last year?
Oh, yeah, the one with Bill Murray.
Yeah.
Hmm.
She did that. But Lucas eventually breaks off from American Zoetrope,
mm-hmm,
to form Lucasfilm Limited in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And Zoetrope was kind of a think tank of a community of, like, writers, directors, who kind of, you know, produced and, you know, traded ideas back and forth. But where he actually got the money from the movies, of course, Star Wars, he got the money from Fox and from, you know, some private sources, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Empire, he used the profits from Star Wars to pay for Empire. And then in Return of the Jedi, he used the profits from Empire to finance Return of the Jedi. And then he built Skywalker Ranch, paid for his equipment. And it's interesting because Skywalker Ranch is completely separate from Hollywood. I mean, mm-hmm. It sustains itself. He doesn't really need a lot of what Hollywood has to offer anymore. And that was when he achieved his independence, pretty much when he built Skywalker Ranch.
And let's kind of take one step back. Now let's talk about what I thought as a young guy watching Star Wars. I said, okay, I need to go to Hollywood. I need to be a part of this. I want to be a director and all this kind of stuff. And it's funny. Now, I'm not trying to put too much on Lucas here, but it's interesting how Lucas said, no, I'm not going to Hollywood. I'm going to do it my own way. I'm going to pay for my own equipment. I'm going to do it my way. And so he kind of courted Hollywood a little bit. And then once he realized that he did have the ideas and the other sequels up his sleeve, he said, okay, I'm now going to do it my own way. And so he used his money wisely, and he built his own empire to do what he needed to do.
Right.
Now, the interesting thing is, even today now, and I mentioned this in shows before, is that the power now is in the person again. It's not in Hollywood. There's people that are making films in their own office, in their own bedroom, in their own house, cutting it in digital format and sending it in. And, you know, Hollywood is now looking for them. So that's why we have an iFilm, et cetera, et cetera. So it's interesting how that people are taking that type of look now, especially with digital film and computers and editing software and all this kind of stuff that Lucas saw. They're taking that same tack. Like, I don't need Hollywood. I can do it right here. I can do it in South Carolina, Tennessee. I can do it wherever I need to be. So
exactly. Yep.
It's interesting to see how somebody that really walked the talk and financed their own films and then made their own studio, just totally separate. A quick funny story is that when ILM was set up, there was a part of ILM that was in Van Nuys. And when Lucas, at the end of the year, was reading the outgo and income for Van Nuys, the money amounts that they were paying out was just astronomical. And he found out that they were limousines and they were having a bunch of big parties. And he said, okay, party's over. And he moved them all to ILM, to Skywalker Ranch, to keep an eye on them. So I thought it was kind of funny that even a part of ILM in Los Angeles, just they got caught up in that whole type of, you know, spin mentality. So,
right.
Pretty interesting.
Yeah, and also you had mentioned this to me before, and I hadn't really thought of it, but it's definitely obvious that Lucas kind of became what he was fighting.
True.
So he became the big, you know, I mean, Lucasfilm Limited is one of the giant juggernauts of Hollywood. Or, I mean, of the movie-making business, not necessarily Hollywood, but mm-hmm. he kind of became who he was fighting against. So.
Well, yeah, even Lucasfilm Limited, I think it's a limited liability corporation. I think it's LLC, if I'm not mistaken. It's just my opinion on that, but it is true. I mean, he's a CEO, he's got a board, you know, and he just, that's what he fought against. And so, in the end, Luke does go to the dark side. It's kind of funny. Let's talk about this. Lucas, the innovator. If yep. Lucas was a lot of different things, he was an innovator. Now, let's talk more specifically about ILM and its effects.
Okay, well, ILM, just talking about ILM on the whole, ILM has been affiliated since Star Wars with hundreds of films, from the original Star Wars in 77 to the upcoming Mission Impossible 3, which appears that it's going to be a little bit different from the first two in that there's going to be a whole lot more visual effects. ILM has gotten 14 Oscars for Best Visual Effects, 17 Technical Achievement Awards from the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. And, you know, the influence of ILM and digital theaters are spreading like wildfire throughout the country. I mean, I went to college for the past 2 years in Spartanburg, South Carolina, which is a boonie town as you can possibly get.
Hmm.
And another small town in South Carolina is Greenville. It's actually probably a city now. But there's digital theater there. So they're spreading from L.A. and New York to the smallest and most remote locations. And it's all because of ILM and Lucas's vision and ILM's capacities. Following this, you know, you're going to see a whole lot more digital surround sound theaters, and they'll eventually replace the other ones, apparently. I know that there's an IMAX boom going, but I don't know if you can really classify that as the same thing, but definitely look for a whole lot more digital theaters coming in the next couple of years. Lucas, you know, through ILM, from the very beginning, I think one of the reasons that everything ran so well was that he spent the money, brought the right talent in to be on the cutting edge of special effects technology, and he hung with his people. You know, mm-hmm. There were some rough times at the beginning for ILM. I mean, back to that documentary again, mm-hmm. Lucas was angry, visibly angry, with his ILM directors and his visual effects people on the first Star Wars because he thought it was so bad, and that's why you've seen so many different remakes of everything, and I guess he didn't really have the money to start with, but he wasn't pleased with them in the beginning, but he kind of hung with them. He sold his computer graphics division of Lucasfilm to Steve Jobs, and that's eventually mm-hmm. turned into Pixar, so mm-hmm. that's also a branch of ILM. So it's been unbelievable. It's had such a great impact on the movie-making community.
But let's think about this a minute. Now Lucas, I think, is a very territorial type of a guy. It's his company. It's his people. He used the crews for the Indiana Jones television series to film the prequels, basically. Right. He knew he could trust these guys, that these guys could make things quickly, well, and use the technology at their hands to do this work. So he's very much a family, if you would say, kind of a guy. Is if you've worked with him, if you've paid your dues, if you've hung in there to do a TV show, then you can do the big time. And I also think that interesting that ILM wasn't just a Lucasfilm company.
Right.
He said, okay, listen, we need to think beyond these movies here. So we're going to have a cutting edge, you know, and that's overused. We're going to have a cutting edge company that does the best electronic, you know, digital effects and blue screen and all these kind of things. But I want to do it for everybody.
Yep.
And so there you go. That's how you expand out beyond your own films, because there's a lot of people in Hollywood that are just, they're afraid to reach out, help out, and all these kind of things. So, again, Lucas, innovator, just
right.
kind of
risk taker too. I mean, it took a whole lot of guts to do what he did. I mean, some of these risks, they've really paid off. But if you look at it, there were some significant risks he took, especially early on in his career.
So. Now let's talk about THX.
Yep, THX. Well, when you look at THX, you also want to look at some of the other tools. You know, the sound and editing that Lucas has he's revolutionized the sound and editing mm-hmm. Fields in movies. And there's actually a book coming out. Actually, it came out late last year. I can't figure out it's 2006 yet. But the book is called Droid Maker. It's called Droid Maker, George Lucas and the Digital Revolution. Mm-hmm. And it's by Michael Rubin, who's a former ILM employee. Mm-hmm. But it goes into pretty much the stuff we're covering on this interview and a whole lot more, from a first-person perspective of how it was in 77 and how it's evolved through the decades.
Wow.
But THX was Lucas's sound company, and it's now expanding at an unimaginable rate. Surround sound home theaters and televisions have spread like digital theaters, but a whole lot more, and they're a lot more affordable. And now Lucas is, well, THX, I guess, is moving their sound systems to car audio systems.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's this thing called THX2 audio system. And in 2007, they're going to start putting it in Lincoln cars. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, Bose radios are right mm-hmm. now, they're thought of to be the best quality audio, you know, production, not audio production, but the best thing to listen to your CDs or whatever on.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently these THX2 systems are going to be something like you've never heard before. It's going to be like your... Listen, I mean, it's pristine, as clear as you can get. In 84, THX was in 83. In 84, Lucas debuted the Edit and Sound Droids, which were two non-linear editing systems which have greatly advanced the animations and just regular movies, I guess. But the Edit Droid, which right now, I mean, he's been working on both of them, so they've progressed along as ILM and THX have. But the Edit Droid, which costs about $87,000 if you want one. It can take shot by shot from about 10,000 feet of film and rearrange them like you're cutting and pasting in Microsoft Word.
Wow.
With like a video game console, like if you're paying Xbox or something. I mean, it's unbelievable how easy it's gotten. And of course, it wasn't as easy in 77, but it's vastly revolutionized the post-production process. And it took away, you know, the tedious process that Lucas knew, and he still does a little bit of this, but, you know, splicing the film by hand. The SoundDroid comes into use because, you know, believe it or not, I didn't know this, but sound editing is far more important than most people would believe. For example, on Return of the Jedi, Return of the Jedi had 5 film editors. It had 17 sound editors.
Wow.
SoundDroid was created because it was actually revolutionized near Revenge of the Sith, because some scenes in Revenge of the Sith particularly had up to 70 tracks for each scene running at the same time. And this creation completely synchronizes, organizes, and mixes the soundtrack into the scene, and it can also alter the pitch. And you can really see this in the new DVD releases, because it talked about how when things are whizzing by Han Solo's head, or, you know, in battle or something, the pitch becomes a lot louder, and you feel like, you don't feel like you're there quite yet, but it's a lot more realistic. You know, the loud things that are supposed to be louder are not drowned out by the soundtrack. I mean, it does a great job, you know, bringing out, you know, some of Ben Burtt and others, you know, the great sound effects that they have recorded that sometimes would get lost in John Williams' music. So
sure.
Those are a couple of his greatest achievements, I guess, in the editing field.
Now, to be honest, we've really kind of talked about his business sense and different technologies and things that he's really spearheaded and really kind of pushed ahead. But there are these people that really call him the man, and that he is just this ogre, taskmaster, all these kind of things, and how that he, you know, how he's become what he despises and all this kind of stuff. But let's talk about the heart of George Lucas. I mean, there's something beyond all the technology, all the business sense, all these kind of things. But where is his heart as far as maybe caring about education or maybe giving to needy charities?
Well, his heart is in the right place. And after I researched this, I came to the conclusion that people who claim without researching that George Lucas is greedy, because there are some that say he's one of the greediest people alive, they're as ignorant as you can possibly be, because this man has given a whole lot. To start off, I found a heartwarming quote that he said. He was talking about, you know, some people will make a whole lot of money and they'll wake up and they'll say, I'll do that someday, as in I'll give money someday, I'll do it someday. And he says, well, that someday is today, and if you have the means to do it, this is the time to do it. And it's a little hard to do when you're building up your nest egg, so to speak, your security blanket, to give it all away. But he says his feeling is that if you can't give the time away, you should give your resources away. And he's done that through 2 primary things. One kind of deals with him as a person, and one kind of deals with his films. The first one is Edutopia, which is kind of also called the George Lucas Educational Foundation, and it was established in 1991 in San Rafael, California, out by you, not by me. But in these schools, it's got parents and other professionals from the community, like architects, artists, physicians, and writers. They contribute their expertise and resources, and his technology is readily available, and it enables students, teachers, and administrators to kind of seek knowledge and expertise beyond the school building. And, you know, Lucas has said, this is public, that he often got bored in school. And so he's really based this on, you know, trying to make school interesting for kids. And he also said that public education is the foundation of the American democracy, and the stepping stones of the youth is how they reach their full potential. And he says, he claimed that his own experience in public school was frustrating, and occasionally he had a teacher who engaged his curiosity and motivated him to learn. And that's what he's tried to build Edutopia on, you know, capturing kids' imaginations however he can, and then using it, directing it in the right direction to help them learn. The other thing that he, this is a little bit, you know, this is a little bit well better known, I guess. It's Lucas and Mark Hamill primarily do this, and it's called Starlight. And it's not, maybe not well as well known as some of these organizations, but they deal with over 200,000 terminally ill children every year. And Lucas and Hamill both contribute their time and money heavily to the organization. and especially to the New York chapter. The New York chapter chose to reward Lucas for his good heart and his contributions to them over such a long period of time by holding a stand-a-thon outside the major New York theaters in New Jersey, New York, and Connecticut to raise money for the kids and also bring more media attention to Revenge of the Sith and Attack of the Clones.
Hmm.
So they kind of paid him back for, you know, his donations to them and his, I guess he gave so much to them so over such a long period of time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's interesting that, you know, even though the debacle of the people lining up in front of, you know, Grauman's Chinese this year and all this kind of stuff, there was a couple of really nice posts. I think it was on liningup.net of people saying, you know, it doesn't really matter that they were lining up in front of the wrong theater. Okay, so Jay Leno got an extra joke. Okay, great. But the bottom line is this is for kids who need some help. And no matter where they're standing, it could be in front of Starbucks or Paris Hilton's house or what, it doesn't matter. The end result is kids are getting some help.
Yep.
And so, you know, it's the bottom line. That's the way it is. Now, let's kind of come in really close to the ground here. Let's talk about Lucas the father.
Well, the way I look at it is I can see why he's got such a big heart and, you know, why he might want to give so much, because it's very well known he's got three kids, Amanda, Katie, and Jet, and they're mm-hmm. all adopted. All three have been in his films, and it's well known how much of a family man he is. You know, I guess there is some kind of tragic or sad news that as soon as Return of the Jedi was released, he divorced his wife,
mm-hmm.
and that kind of hurt him, but I mean, you know, and it's readily public that he very much loves his children and devotes lots of his life to them,
mm-hmm.
and to the extent that he's putting them in his movies. I think Jet played Zet Jukasa in Revenge of the Sith, who was kind of a cool Jedi who flipped out in front of Bail Organa and cut up a lot of clones. So they've been given some pretty prominent roles in his films, and there are not a lot of directors who would do that,
mm-hmm.
especially none with, like, the stature of George Lucas.
Sure. Now, LucasArts Learning, what's that all about?
Well, Lucas has put out a lot of not necessarily games, but there have been some games, and lots of learning software for kids. Now, an example I found was his Phantom Menace Early Learning Center, and then there was the game Bombad Racing, which was so, in my opinion, awful and so elementary that it had to have been for younger kids. But
mm-hmm.
he really doesn't – the main thing about Lucas and kids – is that he doesn't want to isolate an audience. And so you can go to the original site, StarWars.com, and he's got a kid-specific section which has, you know, some games that promote classical music and other aspects of Star Wars that, you know, maybe younger audiences might not feel as comfortable with as, you know, some older people who might enjoy listening to classical music.
Mm-hmm.
So he's trying to, you know, bring them in with, you know, some fun stuff to help them understand Star Wars. He's also released simpler versions of the novelizations of his original trilogy. I've seen them at bookstores before. He also, you know, he promotes his own. There are a whole lot of Star Wars, you know, teen elementary style books.
Sure.
So he definitely promotes those. I know Jude Watson has written a whole lot of them. And, you know, then you come to the question, Star Wars Episode 3. It definitely wasn't a kid's movie. It was PG-13. That was kind of groundbreaking for Star Wars. But, you know, you can look at the film, and there's a whole lot of, you know, really deep, emotional, you know, sometimes scary stuff. But there's some parts in it that still appeal to kids. You know, R2-D2 at the very beginning, it's still funny. And he's, you know, I wouldn't have taken my young children to go see the movie, but if parents chose to let their children watch it, there's still the fun factor in there that we were talking about earlier with Indiana Jones. He's still implemented into the most serious of movies. He still implemented, you know, his fun, you know, signature, I guess, on the movie.
Sure. So. Now, let's tie this all up together.
Yep.
We're talking about a man, just a man. That's all. He really set out to do something different. And there's a couple of things that I really respect about him. Is he's persistent. Is that he sticks to what he's going to do. He is unwavered, even at his own health deteriorating
right
on that first film. Unfortunately, his marriage falling apart. He's probably lost friends. He's probably lost associates. He's lost business partners. But he has been true to himself. That those early days in USC when he was with Coppola and American Zoetrope in that whole kind of family environment, he has carried that through, it seems to me, through these films. That he knows his friends, he loves his friends, and he keeps those friendships alive. And like with a Spielberg or different things like this, he's also reveals themes through his movies that are important themes. They're not just, you know, a Dirty Harry goes to kill the bad guys.
Right.
That's you know, who cares about that? But when you really dig in deep, that's what's interesting about Star Wars is that you can look at it, you can watch the film 10 times and maybe 10 different spots of your life and you can see something different.
Yep.
And I'm trying to read too much into it, but I'm just saying that these are stories that are multi-leveled. I think one thing that we kind of skipped over that's also important is that he loves history. Lucas is a history fanatic, and that's really one of the underpinnings of what Raiders of the Lost Ark was.
Yep.
Is that as he went from the films to the show, is that he's still working on it right now, if I'm not mistaken, on each of the shows that were either a film or the television show dealt with a part of history, and he's trying to use these films and television shows as a visual history, kind of to spur you on to learn about these historical times.
Right.
So,
you know, one thing that I would say, you brought up a great point early on about THX and the theme of it, of standing out, and that, you know, kind of going along with what you just said, his whole life has been kind of the theme of THX. He's driven himself to stand out, to be independent from everyone. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting to see that the earliest, you know, most novice project he had, you know, his film school project, you know, has turned out to be, you know, how he's lived his life.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Andrew, great job and digging in deep and finding these things out. What I would like you to do is kind of explain where you found some of this information out. And also, for sure, I'd like you to email me the links to where you found this out.
Sure.
So we can give proper credit, and also we can let people find out maybe more. So where did you go to find a lot of this?
Well, a lot of it is on web pages. Edutopia has their own web page. Starlight has their own page. And then there's an interesting, I believe the name of it is The Myth of Star Wars. It's a web page, and that had a lot of the Joseph Campbell information on it. Then Lucas did an extensive interview, and I have some, I think you're going to make some sound clips available in your show
mm-hmm.
notes
mm-hmm.
from an interview Lucas did with I think it was the Academy of Arts and Sciences, or it was some major film corporation that he did, and that's where I got lots of his, you know, outlook on life and his opinions on things and, you know, what happened to him early on and how that's affected him. So
mm-hmm.
lots of web pages. There's actually a book that was released a couple of years ago, and I don't think it's available in bookstores now, but you can definitely get it online. It's called Lucas in Cinema, and it's a giant book. It's about $50, and there's a big black and white picture of George Lucas on the front,
mm-hmm.
and it's unbelievable. It's pretty much a survey of, it's lots of exclusive production picks, and I didn't have that, but I wish I had,
mm-hmm.
because I think that would have helped me in, you know, understanding it would have made for some interesting reading.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much for your time.
Hey, I appreciate you having me on, Jeff.
No problem.
Great show, and look forward to Tatooine TV, I guess, has got something coming, too.
Well, maybe.
Not going to talk about that.
Maybe. but anyway, please, listeners of Roni's Own Radio, please check out Andrew's show. He is just getting going, and I really think that there's a lot of room for him to just go. So check him out, check his show out, and again, Andrew, thank you so much for your time.
Hey, man, it was my pleasure.
Okay, take care, man. Did you think you could learn any more about Lucas?
No.
And there's a lot of information there.
Yep.
That could just smack your mouth
Sorry.
A little louder. Wow.
I probably could, but I don't think I could do it like
you hurt Robbie's ears over there.
Sorry. Right. Sorry, Robbie.
Anyway, so a lot about Lucas, a lot about different things that he's involved in. I think it was a very interesting discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And Andrew's a very good little researcher.
Yep, I would agree with you.
And I didn't mean little as a bad thing. Anyway.
You're trying to be cute,
Sorry.
And it's just funny.
Okay. So anyway, Remember, next, Roni's Own Radio, the one that has the interview with John Cosper.
There is a
huge, huge Tatooine TV major announcement. So anyway, thanks for listening this time. Thanks for downloading. Thanks for using iTunes, iPodder, whatever. If you're checking in from Podcast Alley, thanks a lot. Vote for us at least once or something. Anyway, sorry. Anyway, thanks a lot.
Shameless.
Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll see you next time. And it's Jeff Roni and
Colleen Roni
signing off.
See ya.
Roni Zone Radio.